Operation Nadia.
A mother finds her 23-year-old daughter dead on the floor of her bedroom. Who has killed her and why? Is the killer a stranger or someone closer to home? And how can forensic science help solve the crime?
A crime scene is a puzzle that has to be solved. A whodunit, a scattering of clues to be deciphered by clever detective work and the power of science. It was an early summer evening when 23-year-old Alicia McCallion finished work at the recycling plant and returned home.
On the Tuesday, I came home a bit early from work. I normally worked about 7 as well, but I was busy trying to get this painting of one of these rooms done, and I was busy doing that. I was looking out the window because her dog was barking. She was so excited to see Alicia come home. She said hello to Millie. I just watched out the window and I thought, I should stop painting and go and say hello, but I didn't, so I just carried on painting, and that's the last I saw of her.
Alicia spent the rest of the evening alone.
She stayed in a self-contained unit, which was attached to the family home, but with an external entry to it.
Her routine was to get up at 4:30, 5:00 in the morning, get ready for work. And it wasn't until her mother went in to let the dog out, as was her normal routine, that she found Alicia on the floor in the sleep out.
I spotted Alicia's overalls by the bedroom door, and I just laughed and said to the dog, you know, "Oh, Snoopy, your mistress has slept in tonight. She must have worked too late." And I thought, well, that's weird. You know, why is she sleeping on the floor? And then when I bent down to touch and registered that she was cold, my instincts as a mum was, oh, you know, you cover up your baby because your baby's cold. And it took a while for it to sink in that, you know, there was blood smudges on the wall and blood on Alicia's face. But I went running back to our front door, banging on the door, yelling out, "Peter, come, you know, our daughter's covered in blood."
And I heard her run up the stairs and I knew something was wrong, so I even was starting to get up before she started banging on the door. And so I followed her out, expecting to find Alicia probably still walking around, maybe holding her head with some blood on her. It was all very quiet inside, and so I quickly knelt beside her and I leant close to her mouth and held my hand on her back just to see whether there was any breathing, and there was no signs of life. Probably right at that moment, as I describe it, like a stress bomb went up in your head, and you and your mind just starts racing. And I left and came outside, and I yelled at Millie to go and phone the police.
When police and ambulance arrived, we've discovered a 23-year-old woman. Her death at this stage has been treated as suspicious. She has unexplained injuries that we're just working through at this point.
Initially, what we do is we do a reconnaissance. So we need to go in, we need to know what we're dealing with, we need to identify who we're going to need and in what order. So we go in and we can then from there determine what we're actually dealing with.
Forensic officers are called to the scene.
The house, as I remember, was at the end of a cul-de-sac. There were quite a few people already on the street. In a case like this, there will be a police cordon. There are a range of police officers and police vehicles in attendance. There's a media presence, cameras and so on.
So we'd generally be starting with a wide scene examination, photographs, and working a path through to the door of the unit and then into the unit.
Once we establish that it's a suspicious death, we have a duty to inform the coroner. In this case, the on-call pathologist came out to the scene.
He was able to tell us that the cause of death was a result of a large cut to her neck. The injuries c- could not have been caused by herself. They'd been caused by another person, and that this was definitely a murder.
A brutal murder. By who and why? Investigators began the search for answers.
We really have little idea of what's occurred in that bedroom. We're looking for anything that would explain or point to a altercation, disturbance, items that aren't necessarily in the positions where you'd expect them to be.
I saw quite a bit of damage in the bedroom. There was quite a bit of blood on the light switches, the cupboard doors. For me, it was a scene that was clearly indicative of quite a heavy struggle.
There potentially had been maybe a fight over even access to the room, with possibly Alicia pushing against the door and the offender pushing back. And once he's managed to gain entry into the room, the attack has happened pretty much right where she has ended up falling.
Her body is swabbed for trace evidence.
This is DNA that's been transferred through contact. So essentially the skin cells have been transferred to the body. Hairs and fibres were collected from other areas of exposed skin and from the dressing gown.
Samples are sent back to ESR for processing.
There's a number of phases in the investigation that sort of run all together. We're looking at dealing with the scene, we're looking at dealing with the family, wanting to identify any associates or friends. There were some work colleagues that we spoke to gain an insight of what was happening at work, if there was any issues there. Murders like this generally don't just happen out of total randomness. There'll be a link somewhere, and it's a matter of talking to people to establish what that link is.
Alicia's ex-partner Carl Eddy arrives at the scene and provides further information.
He received a text message that had been sent from Alicia's phone. He told us about a stalker that Alicia had been telling him about, and he didn't know who it was, but suspected it was someone from work.
Three texts had been sent from Alicia's phone earlier that morning, and all of them regarding a stalker.
One was to Carl, basically as a cry for help, saying that there had been a stalker. Second message was sent to an associate from her work, basically saying for him to go away and that she wanted Carl back. And the third was to Alicia's mum, saying that there was a stalker at work and she was scared. They are centred around 4:30 in the morning. We don't know the exact time that she was killed, but we're starting to build a picture around the time that the offending's taking place. How he's got into the unit, we're not sure. There's no sign of forced entry. The fact that Alicia was wearing a dressing gown indicates to us that this wasn't a surprise intruder to her. She's had time to actually put a dressing gown on. So it may be that she's already been up when the offender has come to the unit, or she's got up and had time to put it on as the offender has arrived.
Our understanding was that she always locked the door. She always had her dog in with her. So if there had been a stranger, we surmised that, one, the dog would have barked loudly, or two, she wouldn't have let the person in. So in our mind, sort of by the end of that first day, we believed that this was someone she knew or at least was familiar enough with to allow into the premises.
So who is this person, the murderer, that Alicia let into her home? An investigation into the murder of Alicia McCallion is underway. The family home is examined for signs of where the intruder could have accessed the property unobserved.
The scene layout was such that there was access to that address from a long driveway through what we called an orchard area and then through their back gate that led into the vegetable garden and then around the corner of the house to where the unit is. So it's actually a reasonable distance to walk, but it would have been all completely in darkness and there would have been little to no chance of him being seen by anybody coming in that way. So if you're wanting to gain access to that property, without being seen, that's the way that you would go.
The backyard is locked down for scene examination. Full protective clothing and stepping plates are used to ensure there is no contamination of potential evidence. What's the difference between working inside and outside?
Many of the considerations are the same. One of the factors that can actually be quite a nuisance is exactly what we're experiencing now. It's pretty hot. One of the worst sets of conditions for degradation or breakdown of DNA is sunlight, but particularly sunlight in combination with moisture. Those two things, wetting and drying, are really detrimental to DNA.
Investigators work thoroughly and swiftly to ensure no evidence is lost.
We do basically a search of the entire exterior of the house, looking for any evidence of an attempt at a break-in, anyone that may have been scoping the house, shoe prints on windowsills, scuff marks on the outside of the house.
What I was looking for was for any disturbances in dust, in dirt, in what I could see on the window, and my concern was to make sure that I collected all the evidence that I could from any possible points of entry into the scene.
Part and parcel of the scene examination was attempting to identify an area where somebody may have fled the scene, so an exit route. In this case, there was a small depression in the top of a compost heap beneath a fence, and it may indicate where somebody's attempted to scale the fence.
So how would you go about analysing this fence? What would you do?
So it's basically a blind process of sampling any areas that we predict somebody has held or gripped with a swab. So what that does is it collects any cellular material that may be present. Something else we could be looking for is the transfer of blood. In this case, we have blood clearly within the sleep out. An offender may have gotten blood on their hands and in an attempt to scale the fence may have left traces of blood on the top of the fence.
Traces that may not be visible. The further an offender travels from the concentration of blood, the less visible the blood traces are. This process is called depletion, and even when the blood is not visible, it may be possible to find a depleted print.
So Simon, we're going to do a depletion series here where we're going to get you to put your fingerprint in this blood here and get quite a decent amount of blood on your finger there, and we'll...
That's enough.
Touch a surface, yep, perfect. And if I can just get you to touch the surface there and keep going until you start feeling less tacky prints.
And I'm leaving less and less blood each time I touch.
Absolutely. What we're trying to do here is actually see as someone with blood on their finger would be touching surfaces at a scene, they would be leaving less and less blood. You can just go a few more and then stop.
There we go.
Perfect. Thank you.
Areas suspected of containing depleted prints are first washed in methanol to stabilise the material. Then the amido black is applied. The dye reacts with a protein present in the blood, making the prints far more visible. The dye is rinsed off and presto, visible, usable prints.
I'm amazed at how many of these fingerprints I can actually see, because before there was just the odd smudge on this tray.
As you can see from the initial deposits that you made, they're quite a heavy deposit, leaving quite a bit of blood, and the staining indicates that. From about the fourth, fifth deposit, you can start to see quite good ridge detail.
And at a crime scene where someone has injured someone, they're likely to leave a trace of blood as they leave that crime scene?
Absolutely. Every surface that they handle from where they have injured the person through to where they leave the scene and beyond that, if they handle a surface, they're going to leave a print behind.
Adrena treated several areas of the crime scene with amido black. This revealed hand marks in blood, but nothing with enough ridge detail for fingerprint analysis. There was only one print at the scene that was usable, and it wasn't depleted.
On the external door handle to the unit was what appeared to be a fingerprint, and it was visible to the naked eye as it appeared to have been made in blood.
Forensically speaking, this could be key for solving this case.
If you have a positive result from a blood-stained fingerprint, you've done two things in one go. So, as far as evidence goes, it's extremely good.
But this one piece of information needs to provide enough blood for a DNA profile without disturbing the fingerprint.
You might think a fingerprint and blood has, there's a lot of blood there, but there isn't a lot of blood, and they need every bit that they can get to get a proper full profile.
And my attempt to sample that area of blood involves sampling an area away from the ridge detail. This ridge detail is the key bit of evidence for the fingerprint officer, and quite clearly I don't want to disturb that. So basically it's transferring a small amount of the blood stain to the head of the swab.
If DNA could determine the blood was Alicia's, then the print could identify her murderer.
So there's a real urgency in this case to get results as quickly as possible in terms of the DNA analysis.
Can they get a full DNA profile from such a small amount of blood? Police were now following up several lines of inquiry from the crime scene.
There was two noticeable items that we didn't find. The first was the knife, and Alicia's cell phone was also missing. And that was important to us because that had been used to send text messages in the early hours of that morning.
If Alicia had sent those messages before her murder, then why wasn't her phone at the crime scene? Analysis of her phone records reveal more.
These text messages weren't sent from the same location. The person sending these text messages was moving, and we could tell that from the different cell towers that were being used. So we were certain that those messages weren't sent from Alicia. When you look at the style of texting that Alicia did, her spelling, the grammar, the punctuation, these text messages were considerably different.
I knew straight away it wasn't from Alicia. It was just not her vocabulary. She learnt when texting her mum not to abbreviate, and the lingo in the text was just not her. I mean, it wasn't stalker. No, she was being stalked. She knows how to spell.
So again, that led us to believe that the person who had sent those messages, who had taken Alicia's phone, was going to be our offender.
Police needed to find the phone and the message sender. At ESR's Auckland lab, DNA analysis had been completed on the blood on the doorknob.
I got a call from ESR to say that the sample that they had taken from around the outside of the print on the door handle, they were able to 100% confirm that that blood did belong to Alicia.
It's Alicia's blood, which means the print could identify her killer. The interior of Alicia's unit is examined by forensic scientists. The front door, bedroom door, and the wardrobe doors could all contain evidence. To examine them further, they were removed from the scene.
We went and rented a truck, doors were removed, and they were taken through to the Auckland fingerprint section where they were printed.
Why did you remove the doors from the crime scene?
I decided to bring the doors back to the laboratory for examination because there are better and more sensitive techniques that we can use in the laboratory that can't be used necessarily at crime scenes. One of these techniques is fuming cyanoacrylate, known as superglue. If you'd like to pop your fingerprints on here, I can show you how that works. So if you just, yep.
So we're going to use superglue to reveal my fingerprints?
Absolutely.
Adrina used this process to make unseen prints on the doors visible.
Simon, this is one of our superglue chambers, and what I've done is I've weighed out 3.5 grams of superglue for this particular chamber, and I'm about to put that on the heating element, and the fumes will evaporate and react with the card where you lift your fingerprints, which I'll also place in here, and I should be able to show you the results of this in about 40 minutes.
When the superglue reaches boiling point, vapours emitted react with higher moisture deposits left by the finger, resulting in white ridges. Once these are dried hard, investigators have a semi-permanent print.
When I look on the slide here, I mean, it really has revealed my fingerprints. They're very, very clear, aren't they?
Absolutely, and in fact, you can actually see all four of your fingers that you deposited on the surface.
The prints are then dusted and lifted. In our case, a high area of fingerprint patterning was discovered on the bedroom door. The usable prints were marked by arrows and lifted. Comparisons showed they were all from one person.
So they straight away are visually similar, and this is really a visual comparison at this stage. There's not some special machine, you put the prints in and it goes bing and it makes a match.
Not at all. Fingerprint identifications are still a visual identification process.
In total, I think 31 lifts and images were taken from within the scene. A number of those came back to her ex-partner, Carl Eddy, which isn't surprising because he used to live there.
Moving out only 2 weeks before her murder, Carl Eddy assisted police with their general inquiries.
When we started speaking to Carl, it was to gather background on Alicia, also his last contact with her. He was quite forthcoming with some information saying that he had received a text from Alicia saying that she'd been stalked. He was quite keen to show us that text on his phone. Carl came across as quite a confident person, very sure of himself, and really tried to almost establish a rapport with you straight away that he's a good guy, you know, I'm traumatised by this whole thing. Oh, how could it happen to me? When we clarified whether he had any domestic problems with Alicia, he made a big thing of saying that he'd never hurt women or never been involved in anything like that, which didn't marry up with the information we had on him. We knew he'd had involvement in domestic violence. So those sort of things started to pique our interest a little bit.
It was Alicia who had broken off their two-year relationship, much to her family's relief.
Slight celebration, I'd say.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, that he was gone. When they started dating, I didn't really get to see AJ a lot. Carl sort of kept her a bit more separate from the rest of the family. He knew that we didn't really like him that much. He was a bit loud and overbearing and very opinionated.
AJ would come down and have dinner and stuff with us, but she'd have to go back up the other end and cook dinner for Carl separately because he wouldn't come and eat with us.
I accepted Carl for Alicia's sake because I didn't want her to sort of just run off and cut ties with the family, so yeah.
We just really tolerated him and we were quite glad to see the back of him when she gave him the boot.
Unfortunately, New Zealand has a sad history when it comes to women being murdered. Yeah, between 50 and 60% of those are murdered by family members, and about half of those are going to be murdered at the time of a separation. So immediately the partner, the ex-partner, is going to be a person of interest who we want to talk to, and that's the camp where Eddie was in.
His answers, his mannerisms, it all just seemed off to me personally, and the fact that he was trying to push this text message at us constantly rang a few alarm bells with me.
We spoke with Eddie's mother, his brother and a niece, and what we discovered was that Carl had told each of them separately and then as a collective once they'd all gathered at the mother's house that Alicia had been murdered, her throat had been cut and that she had been stabbed. The comment about the stabbing was very important to us. We didn't know that Alicia had been stabbed until the following day at the post-mortem examination. So the only person that would have known that was the person who had actually done it, the murderer. And Eddie knew that information.
Eddie consented to being photographed and underwent a medical examination. He was rapidly becoming a prime suspect, and Carl Eddy's fingerprint was about to be identified in the one place it was hard to excuse, in Alicia's blood.
And you were able to make the match there between that print on the door and Carl John Eddy?
Absolutely. The identification was that it was the right index finger of Carl John Eddy.
One of the things fingerprints can tell you is that what's occurred. This print that we located on the door handle was the right index finger. So to me, that was a case of the right hand came in contact with the door handle where the door was being handled to pull shut behind as you're leaving the scene.
It means he's either the murderer or he's been there when it's happened. That's when the full gaze of the police swings round to look just at Carl John Eddy.
The inquiry into Alicia McCallion's murder now had a prime suspect.
Carl John Eddy, at the time of Alicia's murder, he was 39 years old, some 17 years older than Alicia. Hadn't been employed for probably a good 6 years in any form of meaningful employment.
He was overly enthusiastic in his want to help us, basically, and just seemed to want to interject himself into the inquiry early.
You could tell that it wasn't a genuine sadness about Alicia's death. Something just wasn't right there, right from the start.
Within the first 2 minutes of introducing myself to Carl, he'd put his phone under my nose and was showing me this text message he claimed he'd got from Alicia.
He told us that he had woken up, his cell phone had been turned off and had been charging that night, and he had told us about a stalker that Alicia had been telling him about and said Alicia had been secretive in texting someone.
He would bring that up again about the stalker and it must be someone from her work.
He'd also told members of his family that Alicia had just texted him and said that she's got a stalker, and that was the night before she was murdered. Analysis of the text data shows that there was no such text ever sent from Alicia to Eddie.
She'd go to catch the bus to go to work and he'd be there. So all her workmates made sure that she wasn't sitting on the outside of the aisle, that she was inside, so they would surround her.
The only thing Alicia said to me was that Carl just kept texting her and he wouldn't stop texting her, and it was driving her crazy. And I kind of said to her, do you need to call the police about that? And she was like, no, he's harmless, it'll be fine. So she didn't really do anything about it, but I know that he was the only one that was actually annoying her, was just with his constant texting all the time.
Well, he professed a lot of love for Alicia, that they were great together, they were, you know, it was going well, that he had proposed, that they were going to run away and elope and then come back and tell everyone that they were married. And then as it developed in the interview, we established that they were taking a break from each other.
From the phone data on Eddie's phone, we could see that he was, prior to and even after Alicia's death, that he was talking to a number of other females, meeting them through a dating website.
He would turn up at home to ask me things like, you know, is she all right? Is she eating? Can you give her these rings to, you know, if she wants to marry me or not. And that particular day I showed her the rings that Carl gave. And she said, oh, he hasn't got a chance now, Mum, not after this. And she showed me a Facebook message on her phone. And it said something along the lines of, you know, watch your back, ho.
This threat was received the day before she was murdered. Police made inquiries regarding the identity of the sender.
Facebook have come back to us with an email address, and it's the same email address that Eddie used for his dating website. And they also give an IP address, and it's the IP address for the home computer, that Eddie's address.
She said, I know it's from Carl, it's from one of his accounts, but don't worry, Mum, he's got no balls, sort of thing, so I said to her that if she wanted to, she could sleep in the main part of the house. And she said, no, she'll be fine. So I gave her a hug, gave her a kiss and told her I loved her. And yeah, that's my last memory of seeing her alive.
The investigation had a clear picture, but what they needed was more tangible evidence.
So Eddie didn't own any vehicles himself, so he borrowed other people's vehicles to move himself around. He had access to his mother's vehicle. They all lived at the same address in Manurewa.
His mother's car is taken and examined by forensic scientists for any evidence that could link to the crime scene.
There was a reasonable amount of blood at the primary scene, so there was an expectation that it would transfer with him wherever he's gone, sort of immediately or shortly after the event. So with the car in particular, we'd test things like door handles, seats where you may put something, like a bloody knife or clothing you may have taken off. With this case, there are a few samples that we sent to our DNA lab for analysis from the car. And the only one that really gave us a positive result was from the inside of the armrest of the door, where he would have either had his arm resting or touched the car in and out of the door. And that came back as a mixed profile that included DNA from the deceased.
Police established the most likely route from Alicia's unit to Eddie's house. Then street CCTV footage was checked, looking for any sightings of his mother's car.
We were able to use some CCTV footage from the motorway system. The relevant time, it sort of shows a vehicle that's consistent with the mother's vehicle. The quality of the imagery isn't good enough for us to conclusively say that is her car, but it's definitely consistent with that.
At 4:31 a.m, the car pulls off the road and stops for 37 seconds. The time and location this occurs matches with a text that was sent from Alicia's phone to her mother. And further down the road, there was one more clue. Alicia's missing phone, discarded on the side of the road.
It appeared as though it had just been tossed out of a vehicle, it had been driven past. The location where the phone was found was the path that Eddie would normally drive going from Alicia's house back to his address.
But it was Alicia herself that held the final and crucial piece of evidence.
During Alicia's post-mortem examination, fingernail scrapings and clippings were taken from her. Those samples were sent to the ESR.
Fingernails can be a very useful source of DNA. So someone who's been attacked, they may have scratched the attacker and therefore picked up some skin cells, for example, off the attacker, and they've been stored or kept under the fingernails. And if we get to them in a reasonable time period before they're potentially washed away or removed by some other mechanism, we can obtain a DNA profile from the assailant from those samples.
In this case, they were bloodstained. A lot of Alicia's body was bloodstained, so this is not surprising. What we're trying to establish is whether there's any other DNA under her fingernails.
During the course of the interview, we noticed on Carl's hands a couple of little nicks on his fingers and also a scratch on his arm, which we wanted to clarify how they came about. And he had answers for them, saying that he'd cut his fingers at work and the dog had scratched his arm.
But police believed these to be the marks of the struggle with Alicia, in which DNA may have been transferred.
We're going to demonstrate how that DNA could transfer from one individual to another. If you could roll up your shirt sleeve, I have some blue dye here we're going to apply to your arm, and then scratch with my fingernails down, and you can see the blue dye is transferred to my fingers.
So the blue dye is skin cells, the DNA is in the skin cells.
That's correct. So in this instance, a good deal of DNA has transferred from your body under my fingernails.
Let's have a look under the microscope and see actually how much is there. Oh wow, yeah. There's quite a significant layer on the edge of your nail. There's quite a lot of residue there. So does that mean my DNA will be under your fingernails? You'll be able to identify me?
A very strong possibility we'd get your DNA from that sample under my fingernails.
In our case, a DNA analysis technique called YSTR was used. This looks at locations on the Y chromosome.
Only males have a Y chromosome, so in this way we can amplify male-only DNA, even though it may be in a very, very small amount in amongst a background of female DNA. And there was indeed male DNA present, and the Y profile corresponded to Mr. Eddie's reference sample.
Carl Eddie's DNA is under Alicia McCallion's fingernails. Is this the result of her final struggle with him, or could it have got there earlier? Police established Alicia and Eddie had met a week before her death. If this was when the DNA was transferred, then could it have survived under her nails for 7 days?
We learnt from Alicia's family that she was quite particular about her hand hygiene and her nail care. We spoke with people from her work who described the hand washing environment and hygiene that was implemented there. Every day they'd be wearing thick rubber gloves to sort the recycling. At each break there'd be hand washing, sanitizer, scrubbing, and then even to the point that at the end of the day they'd knock off 5 minutes early just to allow time for a thorough hand wash.
So what would washing hands do to DNA under the fingernails?
Twofold. A mechanical action would physically remove any skin cells that might be contained in the fingernails, and the detergent and soap could also start to break down any DNA that might be present to a point where we might not be able to detect it.
So we asked Tim to wash his hands just once. Alicia would have washed her hands anywhere between 6 to 12 times a day.
Let's have a look and see how much of my DNA is left, eh?
All right.
And there's nothing. I can't see any of the blue powder.
No, I gave them quite a thorough washing.
So again, based on the fact Alicia was regularly washing her hands, you'd expect her to remove all that DNA.
Especially over a 7-day time period, I'd not expect to find any DNA.
Fingernail scrapings had also been taken from Carl Eddy at the time of his interview, and these were found to contain traces of Alicia's DNA.
So that means that his hands, his fingernails, have come into contact with Alicia at some stage. So there must have been a time between that 7 days and her death when the DNA has got there.
The case against Carl Eddy now had scientific evidence. His print in her blood and his DNA under Alicia's fingernails. But Carl Eddy has an alibi.
Carl was pretty quick to point out that he had taken a sleeping tablet because of an issue with a head injury, and that it knocked him out for 8 hours, and that he had been at home and he'd taken his tablet, and that was him till the next morning when he found a text from Alicia on his phone.
When we looked at his phone records, we could see that he had made several phone calls from his phone during the middle of the night. At times when he said he was asleep, he was obviously not, and he was active using his phone. When I went round to his house, he was very keen to show me the sleeping pills, and we counted them, took them out onto my notebook, and using a pen, perhaps as a pharmacist would, counted the pills across and counted 30. But it was a prescription of 30 pills. And when I'm sitting there next to him counting them, there's still 30 pills.
The sleeping tablets were prescribed just a week before Alicia's murder.
He hasn't taken them. He's never used them before in his life. He's never been prescribed Zoplocone before. He's got that, obviously, with an alibi in mind that this is what he's going to do and that's going to be part of it. So he's planning what he is doing. In the early hours of that morning, he's taken his mother's keys. The keys hang by the door. He's taken a knife with him and travelled to Alicia's house.
Questions still remain. Did he have a key, or did Alicia open the door to him? And what was his motivation for such a violent attack on the woman he proposed to marry the day before he murdered her? We'll probably never know.
Eddie's punched Alicia several times about the face. She's been stabbed to the body. He's probably standing behind her, holding her, maybe a hand over the mouth, and has then cut her throat. Nasty, savage cut from one side of the throat right through to the other. He's left her lying on the floor in the bedroom.
Leaving the most crucial piece of evidence as he departed.
So the way that Alicia's mum, Millie, had opened the door was particularly important to us. She'd put her key into the lock and been able to turn on the key, unlocking and opening the door. So she hasn't actually had to touch the door handle itself. If she had unlocked it and taken the key out and used her hand to grip hold of the door, more than likely she would have put her hand onto that fingerprint, and the turning motion of the door handle would have wiped the fingerprint. And that is the key piece of evidence against Eddie.
The decision was made, and Carl Eddy was arrested.
Myself and my partner went to his address where he was living with his mum and arrested him for the murder of Alicia.
So then that was a relief to hear that they had arrested him. It was also sad because he used to profess to love Alicia so much, and I could not comprehend how you could love someone and then take their lives, you know.
Carl had a very high opinion of his own abilities and intelligence. And looking back, I think he thought he had got away with the perfect crime.
Carl Eddy was remanded in custody while he awaited trial. During that time, police were contacted by an associate of Eddie's regarding the murder weapon.
He had had conversations with Eddie about the knife and that Eddie had wanted him to get the knife. So Eddie was directing this guy as to where he could find the knife.
Phone conversations in prisons are clearly recorded.
You are about to receive a call from a prisoner. Press 0 to... This call will be recorded and may be listened to and may be used as evidence. Call connected.
But what we're wanting now at the moment, right, is if we get that other thing that we talked about, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I can't talk about it here.
But how far away is it from where it was?
But you know when you come in from Papakura and you just turn off?
Yeah.
That's when I threw it out the window.
But it never went over the fence?
No, it hit the trees.
On the other side of the fence or this side of the fence?
Closer to the motorway.
Right, yeah then. Yeah, I'll go back and have a look again.
Police located a knife where Eddie had directed, a final piece to the puzzle. And the recorded phone call revealing its location was played in court at his trial.
Prosecution evidence was given with very little contest. In fact, Eddie didn't offer any evidence in his defence.
Following the deliberations by the jury, they returned a verdict of guilty for murder.
Having that verdict read out was a great relief, like a big weight had been lifted, that we could finally sort of get some closure and some peace towards that part of our lives.
Carl Eddie was sentenced to life in prison with a non-parole period of 17 years.
Pleased that we've been able to find some justice for Alicia and for her family.
In this case, it was very satisfying, doing what you can do for the family, you know, and ultimately it comes down to the reason I do the job.
Alicia's a young lady that was starting out life afresh after coming out of a bad relationship with Eddie, with new associates and work. She was a talented artist. She had a life before her, really.
She was one of those kinds of people that was quiet until you get to know her, and then you couldn't get rid of her. She was happy, bubbly, and full of life.
Alicia had a heart of gold. If you were a friend of hers, you were a friend for life. If you needed something and she could help, she'd be there. She was creative, she was loving, and I couldn't have been more blessed to have had her as my daughter.
The biggest thing is, you know, just not having her here and the grandkids missing out on all that creative input that she could have had, and yeah, just not having it around.
Thanks to the hard work of police and ESR, fingerprint and DNA science determined who killed Alicia McCallion, offering some answers to a grieving family.